we come back to the ascent of the sacrifice to the works of love, the works of life. We're coming towards the end of the chapter. He mentioned about a page ago the necessity of bringing forward the true vital being, of finding and manifesting the true soul power, and of bringing to the surface, bringing out into real meaning in our lives, the nature of the central being. He's going to take that up further in this section. And this rather repeats a theme that he also established in the last chapter. If you're working in the Collected Works of Sri Aurobindo volume, you'd find it on page 153 or so. So he continues. It is then by a transformation of life in its very principle, not by an external manipulation of its phenomena, that the integral yoga proposes to change it from a troubled and ignorant into a luminous and harmonious movement of nature. There are three conditions which are indispensable for the achievement of this central inner revolution and new formation. None of them is altogether sufficient in itself, but by their united threefold power, the uplifting can be done, the conversion made, and completely made. Remember, the title of the chapter is The Ascent of the Sacrifice. This is an upward movement. The uplifting can be done, he writes. The conversion made, so conversion into the true principle of life, which as he has described in The Life Divine, really hails from the nature of the Chit Shakti. It is the aspect of the divine power that has implanted itself in the involutionary and evolutionary scheme as the power of life. Not simply life, but prana. Prana is not simply the breath force. It is a great universal power. So, he is suggesting conjoining the higher reality, the source of life here, with the actual life power as we experience it, and a transformation that results from that conjunction. So the three conditions. For first, life as it is a movement of desire. And it has built in us as its center a desire soul, which refers to itself all the motions of life and puts in them its own troubled hue and pain of an ignorant, half-lit, baffled endeavor. For a divine living, desire must be abolished and replaced by a purer and firmer motive power, the tormented soul of desire dissolved, and in its stead there must emerge the calm, strength, happiness of a true vital being now concealed within us. Again, he's not writing The Life Divine, but we know from having studied the paradigms that he offered to us, the map of consciousness, that this true vital being is not the desire soul placed in the surface of us, directing us to get that, to experience that, to go gratify ourselves. The true vital being is part of the subliminal being. It's hidden behind, and it's most, pardon me, its innings in our actual life cannot begin until we penetrated that inner veil, just as we must penetrate the outer veil that separates us from the rest of the world. What separates our outer surface personality from our inner being must also be penetrated. So there are two walls that we have to breach. Breaching the wall inside, we can discover the true vital being, and by the way, the true mental being, and the subtle physical as well. But this power that could be expressed in life, adjoined to the soul, is of inestimable service to the divine plan. Calm, strength, happiness. Calm, shama, strength. What comes from tapas, bala. Happiness, the felicity, the ananda, the delight, sukham, which is already part of us. The deeper vital being in us is not restlessly looking for gratification, for the satisfaction of its desires. It is ebullient and by its own nature happy, satisfied, complete, ready to go and work. Next, life as it is driven or led partly by the impulse of the life force, partly by a mind which is mostly a servant and abettor of the ignorant life impulse, but in part also its uneasy and not too luminous or competent guide and mentor. For a divine life, the mind and the life impulse must cease to be anything but instruments, and the inmost psychic being must take their place as the leader on the path and the indicator of a divine guidance. So the psychic, as we mature and become ready to practice an integral yoga that unites all opposites and contraries and brings heaven into earth, requires a soulful leadership. You can see in Sri Aurobindo's vision that humanity has advanced even beyond the Vedantic underpinnings of the Indian worldview. This idea of the leader of the march is, of course, something that you can find in the Mundaka Upanishad, where it describes that he consists, the being who seeks, he consists of mind and is the leader of life and body and is seated in the food, in the body itself, anam, controlling the heart. So in the Upanishadic view, mind should be the leader of this vehicle. It continues and says, the wise perceive clearly by knowledge the blissful immortal within. So there is the perception of a divine consciousness, but not the discovery here of the psychic being in the Mundaka Upanishad, but rather the insistence that until the enlightenment comes, mind should be the leader. Sri Aurobindo is suggesting a reversal of that, that all the instrumental nature, mind, life, and body, should follow the lead of the soul, of the psychic being. This psychic has to replace mind and life for this yoga to succeed. Last, life as it is turned towards the satisfaction of the separative ego, Ego must disappear and be replaced by the true spiritual person, the central being. And life itself must be turned towards the fulfillment of the divine in terrestrial existence. It must feel a divine force awaking within it and become an obedient instrumentation of its purpose. This is very interesting, of course. The central being, he begins to write about in his correspondence as early as 1933, and it's made an appearance in the little book that we mentioned last time, Riddle of This World. It also makes an appearance 2 or 3 years after these essays were composed on the synthesis in the small book, Lights on Yoga. All of these two, the Riddle and the Lights, are compilations of correspondence that he was beginning to have. So he was beginning to develop what is this thematic treatment of the central being, and to distinguish the central being from the psychic being and the instrumental nature, mind, life, and body. If you want to read more on that, you can find that, of course, in his Letters on Yoga, Volume 1, in the relatively recent collected works of Sri Aurobindo. In Volume 1, if you go to page 55 and read on from there, you'll have a great deal of information. If we were to look into the Bhagavad Gita for something that is akin to what Sri Aurobindo is writing about here, we could find it in the second chapter of the Gita, the 24th verse, or the 15th chapter of the Gita, the 7th verse, where he's talking about para prakritir jiva bhuta, or about the nature of the eternal soul, sanatana. The idea that Sri Aurobindo doesn't make completely explicit here is that the central being, the jivatman, in other terminology, is identical with the universal self, with the atman, both in its static, inherent, immobile poise, and in its universal poise. The jivatman, the central being, would be the individuation, would be that universality seen through an individual point. It is this central being which remains above this entire complex, above mind, life, and body, and in a sense rules and directs it from above, but through the emerging spark of the divine, which evolves through existence after existence after existence, developing from a psychic essence into a psychic entity, eventually into a psychic being. We often, of course, identify that psychic being with the soul. The sophistication is a little richer than that. If you find that being who stands at the center of your psyche, you will find that it is identical with the Mahashakti. It is identical with the Purushottama. It is identical with that supreme being who dominates all, who drives all. That is the core of your truth. That in you is eternal. And what is eternal in you supports what is immortal in its expressive power as it evolves through nature. So the Supreme distributes itself endlessly as Jivabhuta. All those jivas are eternal representations of its central single reality and stand at the head of all that develops here individually. There, the universality, the oneness, the communality, the commonality is never lost, are never lost. If we live in the falsified picture of what is the individual here, as the ego emerges as the machinery of nature to allow the individual to stand forth, we can confuse that with a separate truth. There is no separate ego. No spiritual philosophy that penetrates and gets to the state of what we would call enlightenment or realization permits that fiction to continue. No, that ego is not eternal. That is not the real you. That does not exist in the sense of a being which lasts. It is finite, it is transient. So he's saying here that the... I hope I read that. Perhaps not. Let me read that last sentence again. Last, life as it is turned towards the satisfaction of the separative ego. Ego must disappear and be replaced by the true spiritual person, the central being, and life itself must be turned towards the fulfillment of the divine in terrestrial existence. It must feel the divine force awaking within it and become an obedient instrumentation of its purpose. So there is a universal will expressing the divine intent in manifestation. We can give up desire, but the will of the universe, representing the divine universe, progressively replaces it, and eventually even the universal will surrenders itself to the clear manifestation of the divine will, and you become divinely appointed to your task, claiming nothing. The fruit is not yours. You enjoy the work perfectly and work energetically. There is nothing that is not ancient and familiar in the first of these three transforming inner movements, for it has always been one of the principal objects of spiritual discipline. It has been best formulated in the already expressed doctrine of the Gita, by which a complete renouncement of desire for the fruits as the motive of action, a complete annulment of desire itself, the complete achievement of a perfect equality are put forward as the normal status of a spiritual being. So this spiritual being casts off the desire for works, but does it as an offering, and becomes increasingly, because there's no ego involved in it, first egoism becomes less, and then ego begins to dissolve. And the work done, whether at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end, when it is entirely offered, is completed with a consciousness that has attained samatha, equality, or samatvam, if you'd prefer. So this is one of the early sections in the Gita as well, when it's describing the nature of karma yoga. This is the second chapter, and you can look up shlokas 43 through 50 to see the whole run of what it aims at. A perfect spiritual equality is the one true and infallible sign of the cessation of desire to be equal-souled to all things, unmoved by joy and sorrow, the pleasant and the unpleasant, success or failure, siddhi, asiddhi. To look with an equal eye on high and low, friend and enemy, the virtuous and the sinner. To see in all beings the manifold manifestation of the One, and in all things the multitudinous play or the slow masked evolution of the embodied spirit. It is not a mental quiet, aloofness, indifference, not an inert vital quiescence, not a passivity of the physical consciousness consenting to no movement or to any movement that is the condition aimed at, though these things are sometimes mistaken for the spiritual condition, but a wide, comprehensive, unmoved universality such as that of the witness spirit behind nature, Purusha behind Prakriti. For all here seems to be a mobile, half-ordered, half-confused organization of forces. But behind them, one can feel a supporting peace, silence, wideness. Not inert, but calm. Not impotent, but potentially omnipotent, with a concentrated, stable, immobile energy in it capable of bearing all the motions of the universe. Somewhere in Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, he wrote, "In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power." So this presence behind is equal souled to all things. The energy it holds in it can be unloosed for any action, but no action will be chosen by any desire in the witness spirit. A truth acts which is beyond and greater than the action itself or its apparent forms and impulses, beyond and greater than mind or life force or body, although it may take for the immediate purpose a mental, a vital, or a physical appearance. So it's clear, I think, that his use of the term Purusha here, or referring to Purusha, is not identical to the Sankhyan notion that the Purusha is forever abstracted from Prakriti, nature, and only involved in the connection when there is the production of an ignorant action in the world. But for Sri Aurobindo, this is a more pregnant look at what the Purusha is, as in the Gita, where it may be the supreme person, the Purushottama, as in 11.3, or Para Purusha, the Purusha beyond all, at 13.22, or Parameshwara, the supreme Lord of all, at 13.27, who is seated equally in all beings, just as he says here. A supreme conscious person, capital P, who is universally distributed and yet maintains a silent, unseen sovereignty in all the workings of the universe and in all the manifestations of soul that occur within the workings of the universe. It is when there is this death of desire and this calm, equal wideness in the consciousness everywhere, that the true vital being within us comes out from the veil and reveals its own calm, intense, and potent presence. So look at the ground that must be set to find this true vital being. There must be the renunciation of desire, abandoning that through the practice of good work. The second thing, of course, is to establish in oneself this pure equality, unmoved if something is fair, unmoved if something is foul, not responding centrally to anything, accepting all that comes as the play of nature, as it has been enjoined upon one to endure and enjoy without fear, without quaking, abhaya. For such is the true nature of the vital being, Pranamaya Purusha. It is a projection of the divine Purusha into life, tranquil, strong, luminous, many-energied, obedient to the divine will, egoless, yet, or rather therefore, capable of all action, achievement, highest or largest enterprise. The true life force, too, reveals itself as no longer this troubled, harassed, divided, striving surface energy, but a great and radiant divine power, full of peace and strength and bliss, a wide-wayed angel of life with its wings of might enfolding the universe. This is almost a Kabbalistic image. So this idea of the Pranamaya Purusha, if we were to change this a little and call it the Pranamaya Kosha, we would find first that the Pranamaya idea has appeared in the Shatapatha Brahmana first, and later is identified with the koshas, the vehicles, the pots, the buckets of nature in Vedanta teachings. Not so much, you can't find it exactly in the Upanishads, but the suggestion is there and then built upon it in commentaries. In the Chandogya Upanishad, if you care about these things, the prana sharira is written of in the third section, 14.3. And of course, that's a very old Upanishad. Only the Brihadaranyaka is older. Chandogya. We also see something mentioned in the Taittiriya Upanishad, which is the third oldest of the Upanishads, at 3.10.5. So if you're keeping notes and you like to look these things up, this is for the scholars among you. And yet, this transformation into a large strength and equality is insufficient, for it opens to us the instrumentation of a divine life. It does not provide its government and initiative. It is here that the presence of the released psychic being intervenes. It does not give the supreme government and direction, for that is not its function, but it supplies during the transition from ignorance to a divine knowledge, a progressive guidance for the inner and outer life and action. It indicates at each moment the method, the way, the steps that will lead to that fulfilled spiritual condition in which a supreme dynamic initiative will be always there, directing the activities of a divinized life force. So the psychic steps forward and joins with the true vital to help enforce upon the vehicle the direction that will lead to a divine life, which means that there must be an intercession from above of this knowledge referred to with a capital K, which is the supramental knowledge. So let's not be coy. The supramental must come to complete this. The light it sheds illuminates the other parts of the nature which, for want of any better guidance than their own confused and groping powers, have been wandering in the rounds of the ignorance. It gives to mind the intrinsic feeling of the thoughts and perceptions, to life the infallible sense of the movements that are misled or misleading, and those that are well inspired. Something like a quiet oracle from within discloses the causes of our stumblings, warns in time against their repetition, extracts from experience and intuition the law, not rigid but plastic, of a just direction for our acts a right stepping, an accurate impulse. A will is created that becomes more in consonance with evolving truth rather than with the circling and dilatory mazes of a seeking error. Again, redolent of lines that he wrote in The Mother. A determined orientation towards the greater light to be, a soul instinct, a psychic tact and insight into the true substance, motion, and intention of things, coming always nearer and nearer to a spiritual vision, to a knowledge by inner contact, inner sight, and even identity, begin to replace the superficial keenness of mental judgment and the eager graspings of the life force. The works of life right themselves, escape from confusion, substitute for the artificial or legal order imposed by the intellect, and for the arbitrary rule of desire, the guidance of the soul's inner insight. Enter into the profound paths of the spirit. Above all, the psychic being imposes on life the law of the sacrifice of all its works as an offering to the divine and the eternal. Life becomes a call to that which is beyond life. Its every smallest act enlarges with the sense of the infinite. Like the Rig Veda, these lines. In the Veda, Agni carries upwards the offering and summons all the other deities to the sacrifice, asks them to come. So goes up and brings back those deities, the guide that knows the way up and the guide that knows the way back, always to the fulfillment of the being here. The gods above are interested in working here, in this world, in manifesting their powers. They know that is their ultimate chore, but they have to find the vehicle in which they can manifest. And even these gods obey something higher. Life becomes a call to that which is beyond life. This is again a reference not to the gods of the Rig Veda, but to the idea of the Chit Shakti, who, based on real being, moves into action for the fulfillment of delight, of honor. As an inner equality increases, and with it the sense of the true vital being waiting for the greater direction it has to serve, as the psychic call, too, increases in all the members of our nature, that to which the call is addressed begins to reveal itself, descends to take possession of the life and its energies, and fills them with the height, intimacy, vastness of its presence and its purpose. So we've gone through the section on the emergence of the true vital. We've gone through the section on the emergence of the psychic, and now he's describing what is the emergence of the central being. That is this section. So, as we move to integrity, towards the oneness, that in this together, we become increasingly sincere. And this, as he says, increases, it develops with practice. The more we work on it, the more that power of concentration seizes the elements around and forges them all into utility for this divine purpose. Practice. In many, if not most, it manifests something of itself even before the equality and the open psychic urge or guidance are there. A call of the veiled psychic element oppressed by the mass of the outer ignorance and crying for deliverance. A stress of eager meditation and seeking for knowledge. A longing of the heart, a passionate will, ignorant yet, but sincere, may break the lid that shuts off that higher from this lower nature and open the floodgates. Remember the Rig Vedic citation. Remember the Isha Upanishad, speaking about that golden lid in its 15th verse. The face of truth is covered with a brilliant golden lid. That remove, O fosterer, O son, for the law of the truth for sight. A little of the divine person may reveal itself or some light, power, bliss, love out of the infinite. This may be a momentary revelation, a flash, or a brief-lived gleam that soon withdraws and waits for the preparation of the nature, but also it may repeat itself, grow, endure, a long and large and comprehensive working will then have begun, sometimes luminous or intense, sometimes slow and obscure. A divine power comes in front at times and leads and compels or instructs and enlightens. At others, it withdraws into the background and seems to leave the being to its own resources. The Chit Shakti, the Yoga Shakti, as Sri Aurobindo described her in The Mother. All that is ignorant, obscure, perverted, or simply imperfect and inferior in the being is raised up, perhaps brought to its acme, dealt with, corrected, exhausted, shown its own disastrous results, compelled to call for its own cessation or transformation, or expelled as worthless or incorrigible from the nature. So our nature gets a chance to lose, comes, inspires, pushes forward, backs up, lets us go ahead and do something foolish. We learn from the lesson. We're ready to go forward, led better now by that higher power. This cannot be a smooth and even process. Alternations there are of day and night, illumination and darkness, calm and construction, or battle and upheaval, the presence of the growing divine consciousness and its absence, heights of hope and abysses of despair, the clasp of the beloved and the anguish of its absence, the overwhelming invasion, the compelling deceit, the fierce opposition, the disabling mockery of hostile powers, or the help and comfort and communion of the gods and the divine messengers. This is like that final chapter in The Mother, about three paragraphs from the end. A great and long revolution and churning of the ocean of life, with strong emergences of its nectar and its poison, is enforced till all is ready and the increasing descent finds a being, a nature prepared and conditioned for its complete rule and its all-encompassing presence. But if the equality and the psychic light and will are already there, then this process, though it cannot be dispensed with, can still be much lightened and facilitated. It will be rid of its worst dangers. An inner calm, happiness, confidence will support the steps through all the difficulties and trials of the transformation. And the growing force, profiting by the full ascent of the nature, will rapidly diminish and eliminate the power of the opposing forces. a sure guidance and protection will be present throughout. Sometimes standing in front, sometimes working behind the veil, and the power of the end will be already there, even in the beginning and in the long middle stages of the great endeavor. For at all times, the seeker will be aware of the divine guide and protector, or the working of the Supreme Mother Force. He will know that all is done for the best, the progress assured, the victory inevitable. In either case, the process is the same and unavoidable, a taking up of the whole nature, of the whole life, of the internal and of the external, to reveal and handle and transform its forces and their movements under the pressure of a diviner life from above, until all here has been possessed by greater spiritual powers and made an instrumentation of a spiritual action and a divine purpose. So again, this is the closing paragraph in the book, The Mother. And this idea of a descent from above, which imposes itself on the waiting vehicle, identifies with it, possesses it, happily so. It isn't displacing, it's joining with and working with the lower nature, pouring divine energy into it, and that is that great power from the Chit Shakti above that would descend through the supramental and seize upon and divinize this lower nature. This is, of course, something which has been presaged in the body of the Tantra 1,000 years ago. But here, Sri Aurobindo carries it into the very arena of the body as part of the cosmic purpose. Our souls descended for that. We are now awake to the nature of our mission, and there is no shilly-shallying. There is no time. We must act. So we'll pause there. I know we're in the middle of a section, but we'll pause there and take it up more. Perhaps we'll finish next week this chapter. Perhaps not. So to Savitri, Book 9, The Book of Eternal Night. Yes. And Canto 1. And we're going to begin on page 571. Then suddenly there came on her the change, which in tremendous moments of our lives can overtake sometimes the human soul and hold it up towards its luminous source. The veil is torn, the thinker is no more. Only the spirit sees, and all is known. Then a calm power seated above our brows is seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness bears the voices of the world. Immobile, it moves nature, looks on life. It shapes immutably its far-seen ends. Untouched and tranquil amid error and tears, and measureless above our striving wills, its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things. To mate with the glory it sees, the spirit grows. The voice of life is tuned to infinite sounds. The moments on great wings of lightning come, and godlike thoughts surprise the mind of earth. Into the soul's splendor and intensity, a crescent of miraculous birth is tossed, whose horn of mystery floats in a bright void. As into a heaven of strength and silence thought is ravished, all this living mortal clay is seized, and in a swift and fiery flood of touches shaped by a harmonist unseen. A new sight comes. New voices in us form a body of the music of the gods. Immortal yearnings without name leap down. Large quiverings of Godhead seeking run and weave upon a puissant field of calm a high and lonely ecstasy of will. This, in a moment's depths, was born in her. Now, to the limitless gaze disclosed that sees things barred from human thinking's earthly lids, the spirit who had hidden in nature soared out of his luminous nest within the worlds. Like a vast fire, it climbed the skies of night. Thus were the cords of self-oblivion torn. Like one who looks up to far heights, she saw, ancient and strong as on a windless summit, above her, where she had worked in her lone mind, laboring apart in a soul tower of self, the source of all which she had seemed or wrought, a power projected into cosmic space, a slow embodiment of the aeonic will, a starry fragment of the eternal truth, the passionate instrument of an unmoved power. A presence was there that filled the listening world. A central all assumed her boundless life. A sovereignty, a silence, and a swiftness. One brooded over abysses who was she. As in a choric robe of unheard sounds, a force descended, trailing endless lights. Linking time's seconds to infinity, illimitably it girt the earth and her. It sank into her soul, and she was changed. Then, like a thought fulfilled by some great word, that mightiness assumed a symbol form. Her being's spaces quivered with its touch. It covered her as with immortal wings. On its lips, the curve of the unuttered truth, a halo of wisdom's lightnings for its crown. It entered the mystic lotus in her head, a thousand-petaled home of power and light. Immortal leader of her mortality, doer of her works, and fountain of her words, invulnerable by time, omnipotent, it stood above her, calm, immobile, mute. So, namaste, Jai Ma.